Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument, Price v. Thermer. Mr. Weiss.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. Dan Weiss on behalf of the petitioner and appellant. Your Honors, this was a very close case on the issue of not guilty by reason of insanity. Three experts examined Mr. Price for the issue of NGI. Only one found that he was not insane at the time of the incident. That was the expert on behalf of the prosecution. The expert on behalf of the defense found that he was insane, and most importantly, the court-appointed expert was right in the middle. He opined that he could not tell whether or not Mr. Price was insane at the time of the incident. There was a question in his mind as to whether a psychotic break had been caused by drug use or by mental illness, and of course, drug use would not qualify for the NGI statute. The experts were balanced, and on the basis of that evidence, 2 of 10 jurors found that Mr. Price was indeed insane and was not guilty by reason of insanity.
Let me ask you a question here, Mr. Weiss. We have a standard of review issue, which you've addressed in your brief, and what the magistrate judge did was somewhat Solomonic. You know, he decided that the Wisconsin courts had not addressed the issue of competence, and so he was free to look at that himself, but that they had, in fact, addressed the issue of prejudice, which would mean, under the familiar AEDPA standards, that we have a great deal of deference we owe to that finding of no prejudice. Could you please address, suppose that's right. I guess that's where I want you to start. I understand you're arguing that it's not right, and that's fine, but suppose it is right that we owe deference to the prejudice finding. How do we see our way clear, in your view?
Yes, Your Honor. There was, if we're under the AEDPA standard, and we do, of course, argue that we're not, but if we're under that standard, we have an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented at trial. And specifically, the one reason that's been given as to why there was supposedly no prejudice from counsel's mistakes is this notion that Dr. Drom, the expert who was right in the middle, testified that the reports would not have made a difference. In fact, Dr. Drom did not say that. The question was not put to Dr. Drom at trial, would these reports have changed your mind? Nobody asked him that. Nobody ever showed him the report. So it's hard to see how he could have given that opinion, having never seen the reports at all.
So we're talking particularly really about these witness reports.
That's right, Your Honor. The witness reports.
I know there are various categories of evidence that were in Mr. DeMarc's possession that he didn't, for inexplicable reasons, didn't turn over.
That's right, Your Honor. The witness reports were very important. Also important was a drug test, a toxicology screen that was performed within 48 hours of the incident, showing that Mr. Price had no hard street drugs in his system, which was a large part of because Dr. Drom did not have that information, that was a large part of what gave Dr. Drom some hesitancy and caused him to be unable to make a determination.
Now, so, could you remind me, in your brief, you mentioned that during the period of time Mr. Price is in custody, in that original, right after he's arrested, custody, his behavior continues to be quite erratic. He's calm at times. He chews off his dreadlocks at other times. So this is actually during the period of time after the incident. Am I correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the toxicology report would be pertinent to that, even if you thought he had metabolized whatever alcohol or whatever other things were in his system.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Mr. Price's behavior in jail immediately after the incident, for several days after the incident, continued to be quite disturbed. And you're exactly right that the toxicology report certainly covers that period. There was unrebutted evidence at trial that the toxicology report actually reaches back the full 48 hours to the time of the incident based on the chemistry, and that there were certainly no hard street drugs in Mr. Price's system at the time of the incident.
Does the record show what substances that particular test was focused on?
Yes, Your Honor. I can't name them all, but it was focused on what we would call hard drugs. Alcohol and marijuana were not included in that screen. The other types of common street drugs that you might imagine, I think there was a particular concern about PCP, given the
right.
nature of the crime, that was part
LSD.
Of the test. I believe so, Your Honor, but
that's been implicated in, you know, manic episodes.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that LSD was part of the test. I do have...
And PCP for sure, because that would be another substance that could lead to that kind of behavior.
That's correct. And I can certainly... I don't have the screen in front of me, but we can certainly check it, and I'll inform the court if I'm incorrect about LSD. Mr. Price's behavior gave a lot of reasons to have serious concerns on not guilty by reason of insanity, and it's very important that 2 of 10 jurors found him not guilty by reason of insanity, even with counsel's mistakes. If only one more juror had so found, there would have been a mistrial in this phase two under Wisconsin law. 7 of 10 jurors cannot convict under the Wisconsin statute.
Now there's some back and forth between you and the state about whether over the course of all of these proceedings, any issue about the toxicology report has been forfeited.
Yes, Your Honor. And we contend that it was not. I think it's very important to understand this waiver argument is very narrow in scope. No one contends that there was a failure to exhaust at the state level. The state has not made that argument. And no one contends that it was insufficiently raised at the district court level. The only issue is whether it was sufficiently raised in the first appeal to this court, which Your Honors may recall was focused on an entirely separate issue, a Brady claim. Your Honors remanded for an evidentiary hearing specifically because there was not enough of an evidentiary record to make a determination on these ineffective assistance claims. The basis of the ineffective assistance claims was that counsel failed to give Dr. Drum important information, medical information and mental health information. The toxicology report is absolutely fairly within the ambit of what the claim was and what was remanded.
So it was just, in your view, it was just kind of a for example, important information is witness reports, important information is the toxicology report, important information, remember what else. You know.
That's right, Your Honor. And we concede, as we must, that the words toxicology screen are not in the first brief to this court. That is a true statement. But there are statements in that brief that we believe fairly encompass the toxicology report.
I want to just talk about witness reports.
It talks about witness reports and also important information that's pertinent to mental health issues.
So this is his prior mental health records? That's the third thing I was thinking about, his diagnoses from some years back.
That's correct. There was also a failure to tender to Dr. Drum important information about a 1985 incident in which Mr. Price was involuntarily committed, had a suicide attempt, had diagnoses of schizophrenia. There were a lot of records suggesting that Mr.
And
Price...
And it's clear all of this was in Mr. DeMarc's possession.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. Mr. DeMarc, I should say, testified at the evidentiary hearing last year before Magistrate Goodstein. Magistrate Goodstein heard this testimony, and we think it's particularly important that Magistrate Goodstein found that there was, in fact, ineffective assistance of counsel. There was no good explanation for what happened below. On the waiver issue, the last point that I would make is that I think, particularly in this procedural context where the court found that there was an insufficient evidentiary record and remanded for the very purpose of developing evidence, that this isn't a classic type of waiver situation. There was ample opportunity for both parties to put in evidence during the remand proceeding that pertained to the ineffective assistance claim. And the state had an opportunity to put in evidence on the toxicology report to cross-examine our evidence on it. So no one has been prejudiced. This wasn't any surprise. It's in my opening statement at the evidentiary hearing is that the toxicology report was very important. And we went on to have a 2-day evidentiary hearing that included the toxicology report.
And no one leapt up and said, we don't want to talk about that?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe the state has conceded that they did not object during the evidentiary hearing itself. The state, I believe, did make an objection in a post-hearing brief, but not during the hearing itself. And there was fair cross-examination on all of these issues, including having Attorney DeMarc there to testify as to the issues. So we contend that there was – I think that the issue, particularly on the witness reports, really boils down to this prejudice issue, and we believe there's clear evidence of prejudice. We have 2 of 10 jurors going for the NGI defense, even with counsel's mistakes. The court-appointed expert is especially important. There's unrebutted testimony at the evidentiary hearing that the court-appointed expert in Wisconsin criminal proceedings has special sway with the jury. That tends to be the expert that the jurors look to to as the neutral expert. That expert was right in the middle, and he said twice before trial in his report and in a face-to-face meeting with trial counsel that that he could be swayed. In effect, he said that with two pieces of evidence, he could be swayed to support the NGI defense. Those two pieces of evidence, as Your Honor has alluded to, are the toxicology report and the witness statements. Mr. DeMarc had exactly that evidence in his office and failed to tender it. I should say, and we'll rest on our briefs for the large part on this issue, there's a second part of the ineffective assistance claim.
What is the form of the witness statements?
Yes, Your Honor. So the witness statements themselves, when we talk about the witness statements, what we're talking about are reports compiled by a private investigator who went out and interviewed various witnesses. And they're in the record. And
how long after the crime?
Within weeks after the crime. Only a few months transpire between the crime, which is in June, and the trial, which is in October.
Aren't there also police reports?
There are police reports. The importance of the witness reports is that they go to Price's demeanor in the days leading up to the incident, which is what Dr. Drom said was important for him to understand. The idea being that if Mr. Price's psychotic break came upon very suddenly, it might tend to support the drug use scenario, but gradually the mental illness scenario. I see that my light is on. I'll reserve my remaining time.
So did he have... He had written materials about his actual, you know, machete-wielding incident?
Dr. Drom, he did. He had police reports about the incident itself.
What he was missing was these witness reports of Price's behavior before the outburst.
That's correct, Your Honor, and what really screams out from the record is Dr. Drom's statement in his pretrial report that counsel had in his hands that says, if reliable witnesses to the subject's behavior in the preceding 48 hours were available who might attest to his behavior, I won't read the rest, but he goes on to say it would be very important to my opinion. The counsel had exactly those reports. So it wasn't reports of the incident itself. It was the lead-up to the incident.
Well, but get the impression that Dr. Drom thought he was a judge or something like that and was worried about, you know, the admissibility of these reports. It's strange.
I agree with you, Your Honor, that Dr. Drom seems to have expressed some concern about whether the reports themselves would have been reliable. But I think it's very important to take a step back and to understand that what Dr. Drom said twice in his report and in a pretrial meeting was that there is information in the world, these witness accounts, that could change his mind.
And he wanted something beyond counsel's secondhand report of what the investigators said that the witnesses said.
That's exactly right. Dr. Drom's main issue that he expressed at trial was that all he had were oral summaries provided by counsel. Counsel, for whatever reason, summarized the reports orally but never turned over the actual papers. Now, even if there was some issue with the papers, and even if Dr. Drom said, you know, these reports are interesting but I need them corroborated, a competent trial counsel has many, many means at his disposal to corroborate the reports. Affidavits, a telephone interview, bring the witnesses to the doctor. There's many, many things. I think it's a mistake to say, well, the reports themselves...
These are reports by private detectives? Or
a private investigator, as I understand it, hired by the defense.
Would they be admissible in a trial?
Your Honor, I'll be honest, I had not considered that question.
I'm just curious. Since I get the impression that Drom has, you know, this amateur lawyer or something, and is going to insist that these documents be, you know, verified, or I don't
well,
know.
I agree with your Honor. That
he's called.
It's very strange, but any concern like that could easily have been addressed simply by having Dr. Drom attend the trial where many of these witnesses testified at trial to the same facts that were in the reports. Dr. Drom could have witnessed that testimony, or that testimony could have been given to Dr. Drom. Many things could have been done to show Dr. Drom that the reports were reliable. The first step was handing him the reports.
Did he read the trial transcript? Or?
His testimony... He doesn't say so in his testimony, and I think a fair reading of his testimony is that he did not, and that nobody gave it to him. And so the very first step of any competent attorney would be to hand him the reports. If there are follow-up issues, you address those.
How long did the trial last?
The trial lasted several days. There were two phases. So it was
really short.
That's right, Your Honor. There were at least, I can count up the days and tell you on rebuttal, but there were something like five or six.
Drummer had been appointed before the trial.
That's exactly right. And
why? Oh, sorry, it's odd he didn't attend the trial, isn't it?
To me, it is, Your Honor. I don't have an explanation. I don't know why Dr. Drum's saying if I'd only seen these witnesses firsthand, because the witnesses did testify firsthand. Thank you, Your Honor. I see that the red light is on. If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Weiss. Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Aaron O'Neill, Wisconsin Department of Justice, appearing on behalf of the appellee. This case presents two claims of ineffective assistance of counsel for this Court's review, both of which relate to Mr. Price's mental health. One is a challenge to the manner in which Price's trial counsel handled Mr. Price's competency to stand trial. I think this Court can very easily dispose of that claim. There has been no showing, either in state court or at the evidentiary hearing on remand, that Mr. Price was, in fact, incompetent at any time during the state trial court proceedings. And under Strickland versus Washington, to show prejudice, it is his obligation to show that he was, in fact, incompetent.
Now, of course, your counsel for Mr. Price argues that his amnesia with regard to the entire incident is a pretty big strike against his competence to assist his counsel with the trial to start with.
Yes, he does argue that, but amnesia is not a per se bar.
Well, nobody's saying per se, but by the time you add amnesia to somebody with such erratic behavior, we've often noted that people with mental illness, you know, have good days, bad days, or good minutes and bad minutes, or what have you.
Sure.
There was never any real exploration because of the waiver by Mr. Mark of the competency hearing.
The amnesia was, admittedly, there wasn't a competency hearing after Mr. Price was returned from the hospital for his competency evaluation, but the standard for competency is not whether the defendant remembers the crimes. The standard is whether he's able to consult with his attorney, assist in his defense, and understand the proceedings.
And how does he consult with his attorney and assist in his defense? I'm just saying there was no hearing. I mean, we're sitting here many, many years after the fact trying to figure out if there had been a hearing and somebody had explored Mr. Price's competency to help his lawyer, A, what would have been the effect of the amnesia, and B, how would Mr. Price have come across in all other respects? I don't think we need to worry about whether there's some per se rule or not. There's no
Correct.
Exploration because counsel just decides not to have the hearing.
Counsel decided after meeting with Mr. Price for 3.5 hours, as he explained at the evidentiary hearing, he got...
Now, I think you're missing your best point. The amnesia, that can't be right, because if amnesia is a basis for incompetence, then if he didn't want ever to be tried, then he never recovers.
Absolutely.
If he decides that somebody would like to be tried, he'll tell his lawyer, I remember everything, right?
That's correct. I mean, and amnesia certainly shouldn't be able to preclude a finding of competency, especially when the defense that you're presenting at trial involves an element of amnesia. The defense at trial was, apart from the insanity, it ties into the insanity aspect of it, but he couldn't remember the events.
I think the competency issue is very, very serious, but on his insanity at the time of the offense, the fact of his having a long history of mental illness and these witness reports about his nutty behavior before the incident and then further evidence about continued strange behavior long after any alcohol would have ceased to have any effect. Doesn't that make a very strong case for his having been insane when he wielded the machete, which seemed like such a bizarre act anyway? I mean, what's the point of the machete? I don't get it. It's not as if he's robbing a bank. That's rational behavior. But swinging machetes at people, strangers, seems prima facie crazy, right?
I agree.
So the only issue is whether it's alcohol or some drug. Many of the drugs would be negative by this toxicology report. Wasn't that a really serious failure by the lawyer? Especially in dealing with Drum, who's critical.
I don't think that you can look at counsel's failure solely as a matter of failing to give these things to Dr. Drom. We have to look at what counsel did overall in this case.
There's no reason not to get any. You'd load down your expert with all sorts of anything.
Well, he wasn't the defense expert, though. He was the court's expert. There
Even
was
more important, he was the court's expert. And so there's really no reason to give the court's expert or to have the court's expert proceed on anything less than the most complete file that you could possibly put together.
I think even though if he should have given the expert these materials, the question becomes, and for the purposes of review in this court, what effect would those have had on Dr. Drom's?
Well, I think they, taken all together, I think they make a really compelling case that he was crazy. Because why else would he be swinging the machete, right?
So Dr. Drom testified at trial that without firsthand, with respect to the witness reports, without a firsthand hearing.
Does Dr. Drom have some goofy idea of I mean, psychiatrists, doctors, they're constantly basing diagnoses and prognoses and treatment decisions on, you know, documents of various sort. They don't ask, would this be admissible in a trial?
That's correct. I mean, as there was testimony at the evidentiary hearing.
A detective who's written down a summary of an interview with a witness, why would a doctor think, oh, I can't look at that. Bring in the witness. I've got to be subjected to cross-examination before I can pay any attention to his statement.
I agree. I don't.
A doctor like that?
I don't know why Dr. John refused to consider these witness statements.
Have you ever met a doctor who insisted on cross-examination of authors of any documents submitted in connection with a
I have not,
examination?
I have to concede Dr. Drom's attitude, I think, is a little unusual.
Yeah. Wouldn't a lawyer say, look, you know, the judge decides what kind of documents can be used, and the law is that an expert witness is permitted to rely on any sort of information that he'd rely on in his ordinary practice, even if it's not a legally admissible document.
I think the question has to become, you can lead Dr. Drom to these documents, but you can't make him look at them.
Well, but he wanted to look at them is the problem. And I actually have to say that this case skirts on the edge of simply an incorrect statement of the law. I know that counsel for Mr. Price is really stressing the unreasonable application part of the AEDPA standard, and I think that's probably wise. But on the other hand, after correctly stating the Strickland standard early on in its opinion, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in paragraph 17 cites this Wisconsin case, State versus Layton, and says, a defendant who alleges a failure to investigate on the part of his or her counsel must allege with specificity what the investigation would have revealed and how it would have altered the outcome of the case. Well, it's the second part that really worries me under Strickland, because Strickland is very clear that you have to show prejudice by showing something that would undermine your confidence in the outcome. The Supreme Court has repeatedly said you don't have to show by a preponderance that it would have changed the outcome. You don't have to get that far. So I'm worried about that, and I'm also concerned about the fact that Dr. Drom, as the court's expert, indicates what kind of evidence he needs, and we don't even see Mr. DeMarc proffering him the results of these private investigations or the old medical records that show he's already been diagnosed. Dr. Drom, as much as says, you know, I think it could be an alcohol or drug-induced problem, but because there's nothing else there. There's nothing but these couple of bottles that the police find. But when he saw the record as a whole, it seems to me very likely he may have changed his mind. In fact, he doesn't even say it's one thing. He just says, I can't decide.
That's correct. And he indicates in his report that if reliable witness statements.
How many witness statements are there?
I want to say 12, but I'm not sure that that's correct.
So are they consistent with each other?
I believe they describe different parts of Mr. Price's behavior throughout the course of those days.
They contradict each other, and one says, he looked perfectly relaxed and normal, and another says he's a loony or
No, I think they're all supportive of his claim.
I think
even if Dr. Drom has, you know, is preoccupied with reliability, the lawyer could point. So suppose the lawyer shows the 12 documents to him, and Drum says, "Well, how do I know they're reliable?" The lawyer could say, "Well, look, they're all consistent, aren't they? I mean, that's certainly strong evidence of reliability." You wouldn't have.
And that comes out at the evidentiary hearing, as I recall. One of the defense experts at the evidentiary hearing that this court asked for says their consistency means that they are, in fact, corroborative of one another.
Yes, that's correct. That was testimony at the evidentiary hearing. But again, I think the issue becomes whether Dr. Drum, what effect these would have had on Dr. Drum's testimony and or his conclusions and his eventual testimony.
Wouldn't it be very strange for Dr. Drum to say, yes, there are 12 witness reports, and they're all consistent, but I don't think they're reliable?
I think it's very strange. But again, that
to the point of being an unreasonable conclusion. I mean, that's the part that you don't want to say. I understand you're representing your client, but it's very difficult to see that this doesn't undermine your confidence in the finding that he shouldn't, that he wasn't NGI.
I don't think that whether or not he was NGI is really completely the issue here. Claim is one of ineffective.
Well, ultimately it is. That's the issue. I mean, was he prejudiced or not? That's the ultimate thing. I mean, Dr. Drum is a step along the way, and that's where the lawyer fell down.
That's correct. But, I mean, to get to that point, you have to determine whether Dr. Drum's testimony would have been any different. And given his statement at trial,
well,
that he
dead.
Wouldn't
we
consider,
can't ask him. But
what if Dr. Drum had said, look, I see these reports, they're consistent, but I don't believe anyone until I've looked in his eye. And I've made him take an oath on the Bible. It seems to me at that point the lawyer would go to the judge and say, you've got to talk to this guy, you've got to get another expert because he's completely out to lunch.
I think there was some suggestion at the evidentiary hearing that Dr. Drum, when he met with Attorney DeMarc, sort of expressed some hesitance to rely on these reports. And I think the question then is whether what Attorney DeMarc did in response to that and whether it was reasonable. And his approach was...
I've never seen this before, but you can imagine a case in which the judge appoints an expert who seems reputable and so on, but then the expert's behavior during the trial or before the trial shows that he is not competent to be an expert. And then you'd have to get another expert.
That may have been a possibility.
Mark, he's got these 12 reports. They're great for his case. Well,
that may have been a possibility, but I think Attorney DeMarc took a different approach, and I think it was a reasonable one to take these witnesses and put them on the stand at the insanity portion of the trial, elicit testimony from Dr. Drum.
According to your opponent, Drum didn't see these witnesses or read the transcript.
And I think this overlooks the crucial role that an expert plays in assessing either the health or lack of mental health of the person in question. We've often noted that laypersons may not appreciate the significance of what they have. So by putting the witnesses on, okay, so far so good, but lay people may not know how that adds up either toward a direction of mental illness or away from it. So what the trial is deprived of is an informed expert assessment of what the cumulative meaning is.
That's true, but in this case we have Dr. Drum's testimony.
I mean, you wouldn't go to, you know, me for mental health care, I assure you, you know, even though maybe I can look at things and come to a common sense conclusion, but we've often said we need better than that.
That's true, and this connection was made at trial, not only made through the witnesses testifying and Dr. Drum's statement that if these people are reliable, but it was also made through the defense expert.
But
who
not
did
by
review
Dr.
all this
Drum. Dr. Drum says, I have no idea. That's his final word.
Yes, that's correct, and I think it shows, if anything, Dr. Drum just wasn't a very good witness. It wasn't a very good expert.
But he would
Was it necessary to be an expert? Testify.
On whether Mr. Price was insane?
Yeah.
Well, I believe to give a medical opinion, yes.
Well, to give a medical opinion, but, I mean, could you have made a determination in this case with regard to NGI without it?
I don't think expert testimony is necessary for an NGI trial, although, I mean, I think it's almost always used.
Well, I mean, typically you would have it, but, I mean...
I mean, I think it would have certainly been a strong part of the defense to put on these witnesses, as Mr. DeMarc did, and show the behavior of Mr. Price in the days leading up to the trial, combined with the evidence from the first stage of the hearing that about the actual crimes that shows his behavior was very strange.
But there's a difference between bizarre behavior and mental illness.
That's correct. Unless there are any other questions?
No. Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Mr. Weiss, your time ran out. I'll give you a minute if you have anything further to say.
1 minute to address some of the issues that came up. I think it's worth bearing in mind that two experts since trial, one during the post-conviction proceeding, one in the habeas evidentiary proceeding, opined that these reports are indeed reliable, that this is exactly the sort of thing that a reasonable expert would rely upon. So I think that when we read Dr. Drom's testimony from the trial, we have to take that into account, that reasonable experts do rely on these sorts of things. And it appears what Dr. Drom was really reacting to were questions from the prosecution about relying on fourth-hand summaries of the reports that were given by DeMarc in the face-to-face meeting, not the reports themselves. Drom never saw the reports, so I don't think that we can read him to be saying that these reports, which he never saw, would not have changed his mind, especially when he says that witness accounts would change his mind in the written statements that we have. It's an unreasonable reading of that testimony to find otherwise, that we contend. Dr. Drom told Attorney DeMarc in the meeting, in the face-to-face meeting, he was even more explicit.
How is Dr. Drom selected? How is a neutral expert selected in Wisconsin?
Your Honor, I have not studied that issue under Wisconsin law. I have read comments from the judge about the appointment, and it suggests that there's a panel that the court draws from, but I have not studied the issue.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
So Mr. Weiss, you're handling this pro bono, I assume, or not?
That's correct, Your Honor. Our law firm was appointed for the original appeal.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client, and we thank Mr. O'Neill for his efforts on behalf of his client.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Next case for